This is an overview of Chapter 3 in the Statistical Literacy Textbook, 2009 edition. Slide 2. Quick review of Chapter 1. Remember, this is ultimately about arguments. Statistics are the evidence, much as the basement is the support for the walls and the roof. And the point of the roof, like the point of the argument. But statistics are socially constructed. They can be influenced by things. They're more than just numbers. And in this course, the admonition is take care. Where each of the four letters reflect one of the four influences on a statistic. The C for context, the A for assembly, the R for randomness, the E for error. The biggest two are context and assembly. Slide 3. Context has to do with the factors that are taken into account and those that are not, called confounders, because they confound us, they confuse us when they're not taken into account. Assembly you've worked with, choices in defining, measuring, presenting. Randomness and error are the way they're done in a typical statistics course. Randomness, the influence of chance. Error, bias, any systematic deviation from an underlying reality. Now, the most common way to describe measurements is using ranks. But in this edition, there isn't really much substantive about ranks, so I'm going to skip that and move on to the second most common method, which are percentiles. Take a look at slide 4, where we have the distribution of heights and weights for 20-year-olds. Take the heights first. What we have on the top row are percentiles, 3rd, 5th, 10th. A percentile represents the percentage of the group that have some property, in this case height, that is less than or equal to the associated amount. So if we look at the 50th percentile for males, 69.6 inches, we're saying half of the males, U.S. 20-year-olds, have heights less than this, half more. Similarly for the women, 64 inches, half above, half below. So if you're just 5 foot, 60 inches tall, and you're a female, you're at the 5th percentile. 95% are above you in height, 5% below you. Whereas if you're 69 inches and you're female, you're at the 97th percentile. Only 3% of the women are taller than you, 97% shorter. It's interesting to compare with men and women. Take the average male, 69.6. That male is taller than 97% of the female population at that age, because you have to go up to more than the 97th percentile for the females to get an equivalent. We've got the same information on weights. Unfortunately, we don't have the classification of weight by height. Slide 5. Three ways that are typically used to describe a distribution as a single number, which we know is going to leave out valuable information. Three ways all begin with M: mean, median, and mode. And in the top part of slide 5, if the distribution is symmetric, has a single hump in the middle, then all three are identical and you don't care which one a person uses. The mean is the same as the median, is the same as the mode. But when a distribution is skewed, tugged, as in housing prices are skewed to the right, then the three are no longer equal. And as a fortuitous accident, it happens they tend to align alphabetically. So the mean is the one that is tugged or pulled the most by the skewness, by the extreme. It's furthest to right, the right to the right in this case. The median, which is next in alphabetical order, is pulled less, and the mode least. Now, you may not see this, but supposing we had a distribution of houses and then Bill and Melinda Gates moved to town with multi-million-dollar matching houses on opposite sides of a lake with a bridge connecting them. Will this change the mode? No, it won't. Will it change the median? Half of the houses are above and half are below. We've added two houses. The median moves up one house. Not a great change, but it's pulled to the right ever so slightly. The mean, on the other hand, adding these two multi-million-dollar houses into the sum and the numerator, goes up a lot because the count of the denominator goes up only by two. So this is how you remember it. Alphabetical order if skewed, with the mean being tugged the most by the extreme, which can be either on the far right in the case of houses, or it could be in the far left for a different kind of distribution. Slide 6. Once you've got data classified with both mean and median, and you can see in the case of family incomes that mean income is typically higher, that's going to be assembly as to whether somebody quotes the mean or the median. You should be able to make comparisons of all types. You should be able to compare mean versus median for any one of the rows. You should be able to compare within either the median or the mean column. The most common error made by students is to omit the terms mean or median and simply say income for families with two wage earners is higher than for families with one wage earner. That's an ambiguous statement. We don't know whether you're talking about mean or median. Now, it's true for both if we just make an ordinal comparison. But the minute you make an arithmetic comparison, it depends critically on whether you're doing the mean or the median. Slide 7. Comparing measurements in two different groups, or two different measurements for the same group as in college students, we get a distribution much like this. On the horizontal axis, we have the heights. On the vertical axis, we have the weights. And we could say, as height increases, weight increases. We could certainly flip the data around and say, as weight increases, height increases. Does this mean if you gain weight, you're going to grow taller? It hasn't worked for me. No, these are statements of association. There's nothing necessarily causal about a relationship between two quantities. But it may be a basis for arguing for causation. Now I want to turn to the main topic in this chapter, and that is context, the influence of context on measurements. I want to start with something you know and have known for a long time. What's that? Well, that ratios are different than counts. If I say there are more unemployed people in Texas than there are in Maine, you'd say, well, of course, there's a lot more people in Texas or California than in Maine or Montana. Well, let's go through this and see what principles emerge from something we clearly understand, and then we're going to apply it to something you may not have seen before. We're comparing in slide 8 prison expenses. The first one, it's California versus New York. California's spending $2.9 billion, New York spending $1.9. We can easily say California spends more. On the right side of that upper part of the slide, we see that California spends 50% more. The arrow shows which of the two states has the more. Somebody might say, well, maybe that's because of having more inmates. Well, how do we take into account the influence of inmates? Because that's certainly going to be closely, intimately related to total expense. The simplest way is to form a ratio. Divide expense per inmate. And we have 21 grand for California, 28 grand for New York. We're looking at this and we realize the association has reversed. California started out spending 50% more than New York after taking into account, after controlling for prison population. The association is reversed, and California spends less per inmate than New York. What's the point? Taking into account or controlling for something can reverse an association. Take a look at the table on the bottom of slide 8. Comparing Maryland versus Kansas, Maryland spends more than Kansas, 3 times as much. When we take into account the number of inmates, it just so happens that Maryland has about 3 times as many inmates. So that when we compare costs per inmate, they're the same. In this case, controlling for a related factor, prison population, nullified the association. Slide 9. Now we're comparing prison expenses between Minnesota and Maine. Minnesota spends much more than Maine, has more inmates. As a percentage, Minnesota spends 260% more. After taking into account the prison population, we're spending 12% more here in Minnesota. In this case, controlling decreased the association. Now remember, we had reversed and nullified on the previous slide. Now we have decreased. And at the bottom of slide 9, we have an increase in comparing Minnesota and Iowa. Now I want to turn to how we can apply this controlling for, taking into account, how we can apply this to averages, because averages are what Chapter 3 is all about. The simplest way to take into account, to control for, an influence on an average is selection. Take a look in slide 10. We're comparing NAEP scores, National Assessment of Educational Progress. We've got the 8th grade math scores for Virginia and Texas. Under the all column, the average score for Virginia students was 275, Texas was 273. Immediately, the Virginia Department of Education was saying, we did better than Texas. But when we asked the students, do you have an encyclopedia at home? And we analyzed the data, depending on whether they answered yes or no. We look at yes. The Texas students with encyclopedias at home did better, 279, than the Virginia students, 278. And the Texas students without an encyclopedia at home did better, 242, than the Virginia students without, 241. Now you can see the students with encyclopedias did better in both states than those without. And you can think of various reasons why this might be true. But how is it possible that Virginia did better overall and yet Virginia was lower in both subgroups? It's like a basketball team playing first and second half. They won the game, but they lost in both halves. It's like, that's impossible. Well, let's take a closer look at this situation. Notice the percentages. The percentage that don't have an encyclopedia in Virginia was 19%. In Texas, 27%. We have a difference here in mixture. Texas has a higher percentage of students with no encyclopedia at home. These are the students that are getting the lower scores. Once we take into account, by breaking out the two groups by selection, we can see that Texas is actually doing better than Virginia. So we can make the statement shown at the bottom of slide 10. Yes, Virginia students did better than Texas students on this 8th grade math exam in the year 2000. But after taking into account encyclopedias at home, the Texas students did better. They did better in both of the subgroups. Turn to slide 11, the second example. We've got SAT scores. These are the verbal scores. We're comparing 2002 with 1981. Look at the bottom row where we have all test takers. The average score in the U.S. in 2002 was 504, exactly the same as it was in 1981, 11 years earlier. Think of how many billions have been poured into education, and there's absolutely no improvement. You can see a group of people taking these statistics and running that argument. But the point of this course is, take care. These are statistics. They can be influenced by something. Let's take a look in particular at what's going on by race. Among whites, average scores improved. They were up 8 points, from 519 to 527. Blacks were up by 19 points. Asians up 27 points. Mexicans up 8. Puerto Rican 18. American Indian up 8. Well, how can everybody get better and the average stay the same? This is the same contradiction we've seen in previous slides. How things can reverse depending on whether you're looking at a macro group level or a micro subgroup level. It's called Simpson's paradox. But we're seeing it's explained by a difference in mix. Look what's happening to the mixtures. Look at the percentages in each of the columns. In 1981, whites were 85% of those taking the SAT. In 2002, whites were 65%. Whites decreased as a percentage. All of the other groups increased. Whites were the highest scoring group. The others, the non-whites, had lower scores. So how do we get the average to stay the same? A change in mix. It's a change in mix. And by breaking it out, by selection, we can see that scores are actually getting better in the U.S. during that time, even though it isn't reflected in the average. Now I want to turn to a method of standardizing other than selection. I need to tell a story to get started here. Let's turn to slide 12. Jill is going shopping at an outlet store for silverware. She needs to buy a few pieces to fill out a set. Things got lost, eaten in the dishwasher. And she's buying knives and spoons. She's buying her knives at $70 each and her spoons at $20 each. And on this graph, in slide 12, on the right side are where we're plotting the knives. On the left side, we're plotting the spoons. 70 on the right, 20 on the left. Now, Jill bought 8 of the 10 items as knives and 2 of the 10 as spoons. That's what she needed. On the horizontal axis, we have the percentage of the items bought that are knives, that are on the right side, 100%. So 80% of the 10 items she bought are spoons. You draw your line up from the 80% and intersect the diagonal, you get a weighted average. And you can imagine changing the percentage down to 50%, half knives and half spoons. Well, it'd be halfway between 20 and 70, $45. You can imagine sliding it all the way down to buying no knives, all spoons. Well, then it'd be $20. This is a weighted average line, and this is a graphical device for doing a weighted average. Now, some of you might be saying, there are certainly easier ways to do this. Why not just take the original case, 8 knives, 2 spoons, multiply 8 times 70 and get 560, multiply 2 times 20 and get 40, add the 2 together and get 600, divide by the 10 and get $60. You don't need this graphical technique. That's true. But stay with me and see where this goes. Slide 13. Jim has really outdone Jill. Jim went to the mall. He had the same pattern. He needed to buy silverware. And Jim said, "What was your average cost, Jill?" Jill said, $60. Jim said, mine was $50. You know, this deal about outlets being so much cheaper than malls, it's just advertising. I got mine cheaper than yours. Jill's a bit mystified here, and so she gets the data and plots it. Jim bought his knives at 90. He bought his spoons at 40. And he bought mainly spoons. Only 2 of the 10 were knives. And so his weighted average was $50. Yeah, his average is lower. Now, if we just looked at comparison by selection, if we just selected on the knives, Joe can see immediately he paid $20 more for each of his knives. She can look at his spoons. He paid $20 more. But we want to do something more than just selection. We want to compare in a way that we can do something arithmetic in more complex cases. This is called standardization. Let me back up and make one more statement on slide 13. So, after taking into account slide 14, we want to take into account the fact that Jim and Jill had different mixtures. What we're going to do is standardize. What would they have paid if they had each bought 50% knives? Jill's average cost would have gone down. Jim's average cost would have gone up. And we would have been comparing Jim's 65 with Jill's 45 and saying, after taking into account mix, buying at the mall is $20 more than buying at the outlet. This is standardizing. Now, we've done it for a very simple case. I want to apply this to a real-world case. Take a look in slide 15 at family income data by race. And this is the average family income, mean family income. For whites, married, $61,000, single, $27,000. For blacks, $54,000 married, $14,000 single. Now, you can easily compute the average by algebra. For whites, it'd be 0.82 times the 60,600 plus 0.18 times the 26,700 would give you the average. That's fine. There's going to be multiple ways to work these problems. In the end, I won't care which method you used, but I'll demonstrate the graphical method, because about a third of students say, I need to see it graphically to understand it. I can't follow the algebra. I don't think proportional reasoning works for me. So, take a look at the graph, where on the vertical axis we have mean incomes. On the horizontal axis, we have married couples at the right, yes. Unmarried, single individuals on the left, under no, meaning they're not married. And the heading in the horizontal axis, the percentage, were families that are headed by a married couple. We plot the data, starting with whites for the top line. On the far right, there's the 60,600. Getting that first point accurately placed is the key to getting something that works. Typically, if a mistake is made, it's in plotting the first point, getting it on the wrong side. So, we plotted married on the right, 60,600 for whites, the 26,700 on the left. At this point, we're not using any percentages. Everything is at either 100%, you're married, or 0%, you're not married. Similarly for the black families, we're plotting the 53,900 on the right, the 14 on the left. Notice the lines are no longer parallel. That's not a requirement for this method. Again, to find the averages, we need to include the percentages. Slide 16. White families, 82%, are headed by a married couple. Slide the slider along the top weighted average line for white families until it's over the 82%, you get something like about $55,000 average income for white families. For black families, it's 48% are headed by a married couple. Slide the weighted average ball along the slide the little ball along the weighted average line and till it's over the 48%. This is about $33K. White families, $55K. Black families, $33K. Here we have a $22,000 black-white income gap. And you can see immediately how somebody could say, well, this is racism. It's simple. We have a racist society. Now, that claim may be true, but it's being supported by statistics. Statistics are more than numbers. Statistics can be influenced by what is and what is not being taken into account. In this case, we can tell. There's a difference depending on whether the family is headed by a married couple. What we want to do is take this into account. We want to standardize. Turn to slide 17. Here we're told that 78% of all U.S. families are headed by a married couple. And we standardize on the 78%. White income would drop to 53%. Black income would increase considerably to 45%. And now we have a gap of 8K. Before, we had a $22,000 income gap, a major story, after taking into account family structure, marital status. We have only an 8K gap, much less of a story. Turn to slide 18 and how we're going to summarize this. We have the average incomes before standardizing and after standardizing. The data for whites and blacks, before 55 and 33 with a gap of 22, afterward 53 and 45 with a gap of 8. So the original $22,000 black-white income gap, 14K, that's the 22 minus the 8, is explained by, is eliminated by taking into account family structure or marital status. Set as a percentage, 14K out of the 22, 67% of the black-white income gap is explained by marital status. You have to realize explained by does not mean caused by. It's an association. Slide 19. Here's some details that you may want to refer to when, if you're working problems, because each of the three approaches, the graphical approach, the proportional reasoning, and the algebra approach, have their own unique sets of problems. The most common error with the last two is to multiply using the percentages rather than converting them to decimal fractions. In summary, slide 20, context involves what is is not taken into account. What is taken into account can influence counts or totals, and we do that by forming ratios. We can also influence averages. Averages are already ratios, and we can take things into account by selection, as we did in tables, looking at subgroups, or by standardizing, which is what you've learned. In both cases, hypothetical thinking is required to think of what could have been taken into account. These are the confounders. Thank you.